May it please the court. The fundamental issue in this case is whether anyone, a patient, a friend, family, a psychiatrist, a nursing student, who enters a psychiatric ward does so at their complete and utter peril, or whether there is a duty for the facility to go ahead and offer them the duties under the Premises Liability Act. I'm going to talk about some inconsistencies in interpreting the Immunity Act, which is 1321.117, to include inpatients. And that if the act, in fact, does not include inpatients, those inconsistencies resolve and disappear. Very briefly about the facts. Milana Marcelot is a nursing educator. On March 17, 2009, she was taking a group of students for their practicals to Exempla West Pines. There are two parts to Exempla West Pines. There's a less acute side and a more acute side. She dropped off the students at the less acute side, went to the more acute side, and asked if there was anyone she needed to be aware of. And what she was asking about was an assessment of dangerousness. Is there anyone here who is dangerous that I need to be aware of to protect myself and these students? At the time, she had a low back injury, and she was using a cane, which she left before she went into the acute unit. She was attacked, suffered a neck injury, and required a cervical fusion. The patient who attacked her was there because he had attacked his parents. They were actually, he believed, imposters because his parents were dead. He had refused assessment, he had refused his medications, was hallucinating, was acting out by throwing things at the nursing staff, and was acting inappropriately in the ward, even though it's not documented what the inappropriate behaviors were. In discussing the Immunity Act, there are some problems, and this was discussed in the Halverson case. And in that case, Judge Criswell and Judge Davidson, because it came up twice to this court, found that that act should not be applicable in an inpatient setting.
When they did so, counsel, I think they were looking at it in the context of patient versus patient lawsuit, were they not?
Yes, they were.
They were dealing with what we have here, a third party entering the ward.
I don't think it matters, Judge. I think what's important is that there are inconsistencies in the act if it applies to an inpatient. And Judge Criswell discusses how it applies to an inpatient. One of the acts that can be done when there is a specific threat against an individual is you can hospitalize the patient. You cannot hospitalize a hospitalized patient. And that doesn't matter whether that involves another patient or a third party of any sort. That's the first and most fundamental inconsistency, is that you cannot hospitalize a hospitalized patient. But there's another inconsistency internal to the act as well. And that concerns that the act separates out negligent discharge. Negligent discharge remains a viable tort under the act, which means that if Milana Marcelot had been attacked as she was approaching the facility because the patient had just been discharged, she would have a claim. She's attacked on the ward. If it had been mere feet away from attack outside the ward after discharge, under the interpretation that it doesn't apply to inpatients, she doesn't have a claim. If the patient is on the ward, is under the custody, control of the defendant, they can analyze, they can assess the patient, they can take steps to warn Ms. Marcelot and safety. It doesn't make sense that it's inconsistent that there is a claim when he's outside the ward if he's negligently discharged, but not one on the ward. There's a fundamental tension there.
Well, isn't part of the reason, perhaps, and I'd like to have your views on this, that the provision of mental health care is incredibly important to the state, and the state has said, when you've got these people inside the hospital, we're going to make your immunity patent. When you release them, you're no longer responsible for them, except as delineated in the statute. So wasn't the General Assembly simply trying to make mental health care available?
I think that the General Assembly was trying to make community-based mental health care available. And facilities like Exempla West Pines provide a huge amount of outpatient type of care. They aren't just an inpatient facility. There's all sorts of groups, drug and alcohol counseling and rehabilitation, and other care of patients that are in the community, not in the facility. I don't think that the General Assembly intended to discourage people from becoming psychiatric nurses because every time they would enter a ward, they would do it at their peril, or becoming a psychiatric doctor that works in a ward, that they do so at their complete and absolute peril with the nursing staff not providing information. I don't think that they wanted to offer to make it so that families were hesitant to go ahead and commit their child. If you knew that you were committing your child and that they'd be subject to potential homicidal patients with the facility having no duty to protect your child, I think that it would be crazy to go ahead and do that. It'd be an absolute exposing your child to risks without any duties. And I think that that this is not what the General Assembly intended.
So whether or not the General Assembly anticipated these sorts of consequences, the language that they chose is fairly plain and seems to be fairly broad. And so what do we do with the plain language? We're supposed to follow the plain language and not necessarily think about these consequences.
Well, I think the plain language includes the inconsistencies we've discussed, and it's discussed by Judge Criswell and Judge Davidson. Those inconsistencies suggest that this isn't meant to apply to inpatients. There's also the footnote in the Pereira decision where the Supreme Court says this applies to voluntary outpatients. There is, in addition, the Pereira case discusses the restatement of torts, section 315 and 319. And those torts create a duty. The restatement there recognizes a duty when a patient, when one undertakes to charge of a third person who he knows or should know likely to cause bodily harm to others if not controlled, under a duty of care to exercise, under a duty to exercise reasonable care to control the third person to prevent him from doing such harm.
Counsel, I appreciate that, but that's simply a statement of the common law. The legislature is free to abrogate it if it wishes. And I think that's one of the questions that Judge Boris is asking you, is whether the legislature has stepped in here and established by the plain language a different standard.
Okay, I don't think it has. And I think that the inconsistencies in the statute, as recognized by Judge Criswell and Judge Davidson, indicate that they have not gone ahead and tried to step in here to change the common law. And what was the testimony, and this may be discussed in Judge Criswell's decision, is that the testimony was that what was being done here was codification of the common law, not creating new duties. The concern was the Tarasoff decision, and that new duties would somehow be created and put on the psychiatric community. And the legislature was stepping in to stop that from happening. I think that, and the construction is, the rule of construction is that if there is some inconsistency, if this isn't absolutely clear, that you go ahead and you look at the purpose of the act. And the purpose of this act was not to go ahead and establish a situation where there was never any duty whatsoever and no responsibility whatsoever. The purpose of this act was dealing with voluntary outpatients and limiting the situations where psychiatrists had to go ahead and make a warning or take protective action. And let's talk about the premises liability act for a minute. Because I think it's important, because I think there's a tension between this act and the Premises Liability Act, which is another place where the legislature did come in and say that it's the exclusive remedy against landowners, and it's dependent upon the status of the person who's on the property.
Pardon me, counsel, did you preserve this part of your argument below?
I did not, Your Honor, but this court has the discretion to review it. It's a legal issue, and I think that this court ought to exercise its discretion and address this issue.
Well, plain error is very rare in civil cases, and you know it has to satisfy a couple of things. And please tell me why you think that those things are satisfied here.
Well, I don't think that the status is necessarily plain error in a civil case in this situation, because this is a legal case, a legal situation on a motion to dismiss. I don't think we need to satisfy those plain error requirements. I think that
so has
the discretion to go ahead and hear this legal issue.
Even though you didn't raise it?
Even though I didn't raise it, correct, Your Honor.
And what does that do to the obligation of counsel to raise things below?
Well, I think that in general, the council has obligation to raise things below, but I think that the role of this court is to get the law right and to make sure that that is done, and I think that it's appropriate in this case. The tension between the acts is that there is no duty under the both in the title and in the action of the Immunity Act, whereas there are clear duties that are set forth in the Premises Liability Act. And the way to resolve those is to go ahead and have it not apply to inpatients.
If that were the case, counsel, what would you do with the Governmental Immunity Act, for example, that says that when the immunity is waived, you decide the case based upon the other law that's out there, essentially a statutory provision? This is an immunity statute as well.
Well, that was addressed, for instance, in the Springer case. And in the Springer case, they looked at whether it was consistency between the liability, the Premises Liability Act, and the Governmental Immunity Act. And they found that they were consistent and therefore enforced them.
Why isn't this consistent? Because this simply carves out a special kind of landowner status.
Because there's an inconsistency between the exclusivity of the Premises Liability Act establishing duties and this act saying there's no duties. And I don't think that this was intended to be as broad as the majority in Halverson interpreted it. I think that the concurrence had it right. And I want to jump on very briefly to another issue, and before I sit down, because I only reserve a few minutes, and that is, what does a warning mean under this act? In Tarasoff, the duty was to go and either notify the police, notify the person who was the potential victim, hospitalize the patients. Those are what's preserved and set forth in the Immunity Act. That's not the warning that's at issue here. The warning that's at issue here is not an issue of nonfeasance. It's not an issue of having a special duty to go out and notify. This is a question of, tell me who's dangerous. If there's anybody dangerous here before I take these students onto this ward. And that's a question of misfeasance. And that's not what this act was intended to go ahead and deal with. And that's not the kind of situation that should be excluded by this act. The inconsistencies between the act internally and other acts, the Premises Liability Act, disappear if this act is interpreted as not applying to inpatients. It also fits with the legislative intent, which never discusses this act applying to outpatients. And I would request that this case be remanded back to the trial court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. This is a case where plaintiff elected to assert a claim of failure to warn. Failure to warn was a statutory immunity was created for claims of failure to warn in 1986 by the Colorado legislature, with the limited exception in which a patient has communicated a serious threat of imminent physical violence against a specific person or persons. There has been no allegation in this case that the patient at issue here ever communicated a threat of imminent physical harm against this plaintiff. This patient was in a psychiatric intensive care unit at Exempla West Pines. It is where some of the sickest of the mental health patients come. He had assaulted his parents and he was known to be psychotic. The staff there was attempting to place him on medications, went about the emergency procedures to get him medicated and get him treated. However, in this particular case, the plaintiff, the nursing instructor, was fully aware of what this area was. This was not her first visit to Exempla West Pines. She was a skilled nursing instructor, knew what the various psychiatric diagnoses included, including this patient's psychosis, was very aware that this psychiatric intensive care unit housed the sickest of the sick. She was...
Counsel, I appreciate your recitation of the facts, but aren't we limited to what's in the complaint?
Well, Your Honor, yes, but...
I mean, I think both sides have tried to supplement the record with essentially deposition testimony, but on a motion to dismiss, we've got to look only at the complaint.
Okay. Well, in taking the complaint as it is, she did represent herself to be a skilled nursing instructor coming to Exempla West Pines, and I'll leave it there. But the statutory immunity conferred by 1321.117 is applicable to this case. And under the facts of this case, Exempla West Pines had no duty to warn the patient, as there was no specific threat made against her, no communicated threat of serious of imminent bodily harm against her. Therefore, the motion to dismiss was appropriately granted.
Let's assume that there was no duty to warn based on the statute. Does that necessarily cover what happens when you go beyond that and gratuitously say there is no problem that we know of with patients in the PICU?
I agree that the statute does not eliminate all forms of negligence, but in this case, you're asking, do they have a duty to warn her? And that means even if she comes and asks, the issue is. The statute was designed to protect mental health care centers and staff for a failure to predict violence, which in listening to the legislative history, that's the problem that this statute was designed to protect against, the failure to predict when a patient may become violent. And the fact that a patient was in the psychiatric intensive care unit, the fact that he was psychotic doesn't make him necessarily violent toward this particular person. And there is a goal in Colorado of a least restrictive measure. So you can't just tie the patient up because they might harm somebody some point in time. They have to be in the least restrictive setting available. And in this particular case, he was in a psychiatric care unit, but he had made no specific threats of imminent harm. So there was no duty to warn. And that's the claim that was brought here. There was no other claim that we were discussing today. It's the failure to warn that the plaintiff brought before the court and what we're considering. The case of Halverson versus Pikes Peak Family Counseling Centers has held that this statute is applicable to both inpatient and outpatient settings. There's no need to resort to legislative history, as plaintiff has urged this court to do. And the legislative history in and of itself didn't delineate, as the statute didn't delineate, between inpatient and outpatient settings, nor should it. Now, while there was more discussion in the legislative history about certain cases that occurred in outpatient setting, that's because this type of injury, violence to another person, may occur in an outpatient setting. It happens more often when a patient is at home or out in the community where he might seek to harm someone. But it also occurs in an inpatient setting. And to say that it doesn't apply in an inpatient setting, would then make the healthcare providers, again, have to be liable for predicting violence of each and every patient, which simply cannot be done. So therefore, the exception here, which is to warn only in specific cases, still holds. So if the patient, for example, in group therapy that day, indicated to the therapist, when my mother comes this afternoon for the family group session, I am going to kill her. Well, then the facility would have a duty to warn the mother at that point in time, because it would be a communicated serious threat of imminent harm to that specific person, the mother. In this particular case, the plaintiff is asking us to simply wipe out the immunity granted in 1986 and make all healthcare providers liable for a failure to predict when a psychiatric patient is going to become violent.
So, counsel,
So, counsel, in your view, has the legislature created a situation where the healthcare provider is totally immune from liability in the inpatient on inpatient violence situation?
I don't think it's abrogated. I don't think it's abrogated each and every type of negligence that may occur. I'm not a plaintiff counsel, and I'm not very good at sitting down and trying to determine each and every type of claim that a plaintiff might bring. But I envision that there are some types of negligent cases. For example, the negligent failure to care and treat a patient isn't waived by this. But certainly when a person like the plaintiff here has brought a failure to warn case, that immunity applies.
For example, this patient, if he had made no specific threats against another inpatient, yet there's some reason to know that he's prone to attack, and if he had attacked another inpatient instead of an outside visitor, are you saying that the statute provides immunity in that situation as well?
Well, that was the issue that was discussed in Halverson, where a inpatient psychiatric patient sexually assaulted another psychiatric inpatient, and that issue was considered, and the Halverson court discussed this particular issue, but they found that because there had at least been some communicated threats as in the complaint, that there had been some communicated threat or interest in harming this patient that had been sexually assaulted, that a claim was indeed stated.
As another division of the Court of Appeals, though, we're free to disagree with the majority in Halverson, right?
I think that the court is always free to do and at times does disagree with other courts. But I would urge in this particular case, because this particular statutory immunity is so vital to the protection of our scarce mental health resources, that this immunity should be upheld.
Pardon me, counsel.
Sure.
I'd like to take another step down the road of trying to figure out just where you think this immunity ends. Assume that the patient in group says, I am very angry today. You know, I think I'm just going to explode, and who's ever around me, God help you. Now, that's not really a specific person. It's not, I want to kill my mother. It's, I just represent a problem here, and I may be violent with someone. Is there a duty to warn there?
No, there is not a duty to warn. There may be a duty on the mental health care providers to sit down and assess this patient's level of dangerousness or whether additional measures are needed under the hospitalization to treat in a different manner. So whether they
But if I may,
sure.
You're saying that a person who's expressed a prospect and desire to become violent generally, and you have a stranger come into the ward, there's no duty to warn that stranger that this fellow over here has suggested that he might be violent to someone today?
Under the terms of 1321.117, the only time that there's an exception to the duty to warn is when the patient communicates a serious threat of imminent physical violence against a specific person or persons. That's the limited exception to the statutory immunity. So I would argue that under those circumstances, there is no duty to warn unless there's a specific threat made.
Under Judge Bernard's hypothetical, though, and you recognize this in the statute, it deals with specific person. Right. Why isn't it applicable when you say, people better stay away from me today?
Because
you know anybody coming close to the gentleman is going to be in a situation like that.
And let me discuss what one of the psychiatrists who discussed this in the legislative history said, is that just because a patient voices violent threats doesn't mean they're going to carry them out. So the prediction of actual violence is limited, because there are certain patients that will make these kind of statements on a routine basis but never actually carry them out.
What's the harm of, why shouldn't you say, hey folks, watch out for Bill, because today he's communicated a threat? What's wrong with saying there's a duty like that here?
Because once you impose that duty, you increase the liability for all healthcare, mental health care workers and facilities to be liable every time some psychiatric patient utters some type of threat of violence, in a non-specific manner that wouldn't fit under the exceptions. And the problem with that leads to issues that, again, were discussed quite succinctly in the legislative history, that it then forces the mental health workers to over-predict violence. Jeff Metzner, who's a psychiatrist who is a proponent of this bill, said that as it was, two-thirds of the time when they're attempting to predict violence, they were wrong. And so if you impose this liability, this general overall duty on everyone to predict violence, it creates situations that are damaging to the healthcare, mental health care structure in our state. One, it makes healthcare providers have to over-predict on a routine basis to protect themselves. It puts them at odds with the patient, because they have to protect themselves, and so every time a patient utters something, they have to hospitalize them or call the police or take additional measures. That may not be in the patient's best interests. It also creates a situation where we are overutilizing the already scarce resources of mental health facilities in Colorado. And as you may be aware, over the years, the number of psychiatric facilities in Colorado has decreased over time. And so the number of beds are limited. So if we continue to force that liability on mental health workers, everybody needs to be admitted. There's not going to be enough beds. The next thing it does is it hampers the physician patient or the psychiatric, the mental health care worker patient relationship, because the patient is now no longer free to come in and discuss his thoughts and concerns and feelings, because he knows if he says, I'm really feeling violent today, I'm upset, I'm angry, he's going to get hospitalized. And so therefore he can't come in and vocalize what he is feeling, because he knows that the mental health care worker will automatically have to admit him to deal with this issue of duty. And therefore, it will stop him from coming in and vocalizing what he's truly feeling, hampering his own care and treatment.
That argument wouldn't apply to people who are already hospitalized, right?
No, I think it absolutely does apply, because even though a patient's hospitalized, simply being on the ward is not the most restrictive step that can happen. The next step up from that might be being placed in seclusion. And the next step up from that might be being placed in four-point restraints. And so when you start imposing a duty upon the mental health care worker, it no longer becomes least restrictive measures for these patients. It becomes, we are going to have to impose the most restrictive measures on you to protect ourselves. Thank you.
I think there's a fundamental issue that needs to be clarified, and that is what's really being asked of the healthcare providers in this situation. It's not to crystal ball violence. It's to assess dangerousness. And this was discussed at length in the Pereira decision. And what the court noted is that mental health care providers are very adept at assessing dangerousness. Issues concerning hospitalization are made based upon an assessment of dangerousness. Dangerousness to self, dangerousness to others, and there's a third category of individuals who end up on the hospital wards, and those are people who are are gravely irresponsible, have a problem identifying that people who are making bad decisions and have a problem identifying that they're making bad decisions. So when Milana Marcelot comes to that ward, there may be individuals on that ward who are there because they're suicidal. There may be people on that ward who are there because they're making bad decisions. Just because it's an acute ward doesn't mean that people are there because they present risk to others. And asking the staff to go ahead and assess dangerousness, something they're required to do, because they're required to do it to determine whether somebody in the first place needs to be in the hospital, in the second instance, to determine the level of hospitalization required, and in the third instance, to determine when they're appropriate for release. Assessing dangerousness is part and parcel of the practice of a mental health facility. And asking, Milana Marcelot asking, is there anybody I need to be aware of, is asking to be informed, what was your dangerousness assessment of the people on this ward? And if that is done in a manner that is either negligent, either the assessment or the relation of the information from the assessment, Ms. Marcelot ought to have a remedy. This is not the situation that this act was meant to apply to. This act is meant to apply to a patient in an outpatient setting where there is a potential risk of violence, and there is no duty on a healthcare provider in that outpatient setting to go ahead and warn the world of somebody who may be violent. I mean, the unfortunate thing is we're talking here, and this is really the kind of the Aurora theater setting. That in that setting, there isn't a duty to go forward and warn unless he's made a specific threat. We're not talking about a patient who is under the custody and control of the defendant hospital. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.